a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. Well, hi folks, this is Jack Spirko with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday. Beginning with the oldest of them and going forward, there's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years. So sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. And today we are flashing back to June the 15th, 2011. This is episode 685. This is Dr. Eric Wilkie on survival medicine. And we've hit kind of a part of the show's history with this episode, and honestly a couple of the prior episodes, I just didn't really realize it, where we're hitting, where we're having, as I'm getting the old episodes and repackaging them into the flashbacks, there's two in a row. And that's because this was in 2011 when we were living in Arkansas. So this is during, we were high atop the Highway 7 Ridge Line, if you guys remember that from TSPC headquarters, right? The anthill. So we were up there for a few years, and this is in that time frame. Well, we had some really interesting interviews at that time. It actually got difficult to be able to do two interviews a week every week, and it was taking away from a lot of the stuff that I wanted to cover more deep dive individually. So we eventually decided to go back to a single interview a week. But that was quite a long period of history in the show where you had two a week. Dr. Wilkie was a great interview. I think you'll really enjoy it. So we'll flash back to that for you now. Covering some real nuts and bolts stuff on dealing with medical emergencies. This is so long ago, it predates Doc Bones' involvement with TSPC anyway, right? The other thing I wanted to do today real quick before we drop into the old episode is remind you guys that you can help support us by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. And right now, there's a few things that I have up, and I'll make sure there's links to all this stuff in today's show notes. Again, this is Friday Flashbacks, episode 40 of the show. And just pull that one up, and you'll find all this stuff. But yesterday I put out these great stainless steel work tables from Vivor. These things are awesome, and just anywhere you're thinking, boy, it'd be great to have a workspace there. There's a lot of options. There's a dedicated barbecue grill cart. Somebody yesterday picked up the little med cart, which when I looked at it, I'm like, there's uses for this other than a doctor's office. That was actually the one that made, I found it when I was doing some research on Vivor product, figuring out what I wanted to do for you guys next. So there's a lot of really great stainless steel tables. Some of them are like super heavy duty stuff. Some of them are more light duty stuff. But I give you a pretty good breakdown of them in the write-up. Also, the electric sausage stuffer. Guys, that thing is awesome. I know it's a big expense, but it's the kind of thing, it's a buy once, cry once type of expense. And if you like making sausage, like it is a night and day difference going from a manual press to an electric press. Like, if you've ever done it with a grinder attachment, you probably did it once or twice. Like, I don't want to do this anymore. And if you ever just even made the move from a electric grinder with an attachment to going to something like a manual press, you know the improvement. It's like doing it a second time. It is so wonderful. I'm going to be making sausage, like, from here on out to the workshop, just to make enough for all of you guys. It's pretty awesome. I have a new video that will be coming out probably Monday on a batch that I'm making right now, a brisket jalapeno sausage, which was something I theorized when I did the write-up on that. And I did save about 3/4 pound of brisket fat. That's going to get incorporated with chicken thigh meat. And we're going to do a Jamaican jerk chicken product as well. And what I'm trying to do is make sure that
these sausages, I mean, a lot of it's just for me, but I'm trying to make up a couple different test batches and come up with like three varieties for our big meal on Saturday night at the workshop. That's kind of our big super meal, right? That's like the last meal before everybody goes home, and we try to like, we do good, then we do better, and then we do great kind of through the 3 days. And I'm trying to make at least two of the three zero pork, because we do have some people that don't consume pork in the community. But you want to check that out. Check out the slushy machine I brought to you this week. I got a bunch of stuff coming next week, by the way. I've got a car refrigerator, which is maybe a cooler with a built-in compressor that can freeze or keep things cold with no ice. That's going to be cool. I've got some lights coming from Vivor. I've got an extension cord that is on a metal retrieving reel, kind of like the air hose. So I got some cool stuff coming next week. So you have that to look forward to with that. Let's go ahead and flashback to June the 15th. 2011, Dr. Eric Wilkie on survival medicine. All right, folks, and as I said during the introduction segment, we are fortunate today to have Dr. Eric Wilkie with us today. Dr. Wilkie is a residency-trained emergency medical physician. He's been in practice for over 12 years. He also directs local fire department tactical medics for his area SWAT team. He's traveled to Africa to deliver medical care in some pretty harsh environments and dealt with some very limited resources. And he's agreed to come on the show today and talk a little bit about survival medicine and what we can do to improve our overall survivability. Dr. Wilkie, thanks for joining us today on the show.
Thank you, Mr. Spierko.
Well, I'm glad to have you here, man. And, I mean, let's get right to it. We wanted to basically have you on the show today to talk about some common diseases and things that happen to people, specifically the stuff that we would worry about in a really bad situation with the potential to kill us, and recognize what we can do with them and our limitations as civilians and how we can work with medical professionals and how we can treat whatever we've got. And what I wanted to kind of start out with is let's just start out with what are the top things that actually do kill people worldwide?
All right, that sounds great. Now, since I live in a world that deals with lawyers, my disclaimer is that, you know, some of my medical advice is not intended to supplant that of a licensed practitioner. And so that, how's that for lawyer ease?
Excellent.
I think, you know, it's the non-sexy stuff that gets us, really. So when we look at what the problems that we'd be facing in an austere environment, again, like you said, I've been to Africa. I've practiced with very limited resources. But then, you know, if you just look at what happens domestically, you know, we just had, you know, Joplin, Missouri with a tornado, and you've had recent floods in the Mississippi area. There were floods back east last year. And, you know, so there's a lot of things that can disrupt what's kind of our normal status. And typically when we do that, it's going to focus, you know, around these easy-to-acquire waterborne type infections. You know, diarrhea, for as unsexy as that one sounds, that is one of the main killers worldwide in the third world. And again, so if you take away sort of first world protections, you know, with our water supply and our sewage processing and all that sort of stuff, then we're kind of back in that same mode. So from a high income standpoint, coronary artery disease, stroke, pneumonia, emphysema or COPD related to smoking, those are the things that are some of the top killers. As you kind of go down the socioeconomic scale, and again, imagine going from first world to second world to third world, you know, you still have coronary artery disease and stroke on there. So, but things start popping up on the list that's not on the high income one. It's like diarrhea, malaria, tuberculosis, pneumonia, prematurity, low birth weight, that sort of thing. So that kind of gives us kind of a general spectrum of some of the things that we deal with.
Very cool. Now, can we talk about, okay, some of these things, you know, how does a physician, a doctor, treat something like a diarrheal illness or a skin infection or lower respiratory tract infections in these harsh environments or right here where we don't have a harsh environment? But what does maybe a civilian have to worry about if we're in that harsh environment and medical care is not available? Can you kind of contrast the two?
Absolutely. So number one, I'm going to run on the assumption that people haven't been listening to you about buying a Berkey water filter, and so they don't have any mechanism of purifying water to begin with. So one of the first steps on a lot of these things that you're going to have to treat people for, you know, some degree of dehydration or fluid replacement is going to be important. So we're going to have to build, you know, water that's usable for us. The first is just clean water. So whether you're going to boil it or treat it, you know, you have to find some way to make this water safe. Now, I've heard you mention this before, and it's absolutely correct. Once you bring water to a boil, once you see the rolling boil, you're good. You know, you don't have to, you know, keep it there for 3 minutes or 5 minutes or whatever else, unless perhaps you're hiking in the Himalayas. But most pathogens, most of the stuff that's going to cause problems for us, are going to get killed somewhere around 140 and 158 degrees Fahrenheit, or 60 to 70 degrees Celsius for the foreign listeners. So once you get to boiling, you've well exceeded that. So boiling's great, but the problem is boiling's, you know, energy intensive. Sometimes you don't always have the resources available. Using standard chlorine is a great one, and it'll give the water perhaps a little bit of a funny taste. But you can easily come up with the criteria for what you need to do. For an example, if you're using 1% chlorine and you're going to try and do a gallon, you need about 40 drops of chlorine for that. So you got to make sure you have a way of dosing with a dropper so you don't overdo it. But chlorine's great, easy to store, easy to keep. But the problem, there's chlorine doesn't always work with some infections like Giardia, which causes chronic diarrhea. Chlorine can be a little unreliable with that one. Iodine, another really good thing, easy to have around, and this is what I have in my camping kit when I go camping, because I can take a small bottle of iodine, and it takes just very little to sterilize or at least make water potable. And I use Betadine. It comes in a 30 milliliter bottle, and that will do 150 liters of water in terms of disinfecting it, so that works really good. The key thing with iodine and chlorine both is you're going to have to make sure it sits for a while before the water is clear. If the water is really nasty, cloudy, ugly, you know, it needs to sit for an hour for that iodine and chlorine to kill off everything. If the water is very clear, you can cut that in half to maybe 30 minutes. And then if you don't really have anything other than perhaps a 2-liter plastic bottle, what you can do is take the wrapper off of the plastic bottle, make sure it's just clear plastic, fill it with water, and put it up on a roof or something that's going to get a lot of sunlight. And if you leave it up there for several hours on a sunny day, it can't be a cloudy day, it needs to be a nice sunny day, but if you leave it up there for about 6 hours, then that will make the water pretty safe to drink. So number one, make your water safe. Number two is making it so it can be a rehydration fluid with either salt and potassium and sugar. And again, you can just use plain salt, plain sugar to kind of get a rehydration solution. And the way you do that is that, let's say if you got a liter, which is the same thing, about 4 cups, say. You put 8 teaspoons of sugar, 1 teaspoon of salt, and then if you can squeeze some oranges or, you know, mash a little banana to get the potassium in there, that works great too. So number one is you got to have good water that's going to be safe for human consumption. Number two is if you've lost a lot of water from dehydration, you need to replace some of the salts, and you do that with the sugar and the salt mixed together. And then if we want to talk specifically about the diarrhea, how do we treat that? You've got bacterial causes and viral causes. In the U.S., under normal conditions, viruses way outweigh bacteria in terms of the cause of diarrhea. So antibiotics really aren't going to help a viral diarrhea. You just got to wait it out, stay hydrated. And so anywhere between 50% to 70% of diarrhea cases in the U.S. are viral. The famous one is this norovirus that used to be called Norwalk virus. And so when people hear about the terrible diarrhea cases on the cruise ships, that's typically this norovirus. Now, if it's bacterial, and that could be E. coli, of course, that's hitting the news with what's going on in Germany now. You know, it could be cholera, which was a big outbreak in Haiti not too long ago. Shigella, you know, Salmonella is on the rise in the United States. There was just an alert that came across the internet yesterday about that. And then there's the more chronic ones that can cause long-lasting diarrhea, like Entamoeba, Histolytica, which is an amoeba, Cryptosporidium, and Giardia. All right, so now, how do we approach that? How do we put this together in terms of a treatment pathway? So if it's just kind of watery diarrhea, no fever, no blood in the stool, no big mucus in the stool, then I'm going to presume it to be a virus and just kind of treat with fluids. If you've got blood or you've got associated fever, or there's a lot of mucus in the stool, or if you have this, and again, I don't want to gross anybody out, but if this kind of white floating stool, which means you're not digesting fats, that's another big tip off that it's a you know, probably a Giardia or bacterial infection. So that's going to need, you know, some antibiotics typically. Most of the diseases will go away on their own despite whether or not you use antibiotics, but antibiotics can shorten the duration of illness and perhaps limit some of the side effects. And what we typically use is a drug called a fluoroquinolone, which is ciprofloxacin and norfloxacin. The other thing that works pretty well is if people have ever taken a Z-Pak, which is azithromycin, that works pretty well in diarrhea. The old standby like doxycycline can be used in some cases. And then if you have one of these unusual ones, this entamoeba, which is an amoeba, or the Giardia, which causes the white floating stools with the fat malabsorption, then you have to use a special drug called Flagyl, which is also metronidazole. Very important, though, don't drink alcohol with that one. You can get really bad sick. So that may be a little too much information.
No, that's great. I just want to make sure people understand something here, that we tend to look at something like diarrhea in the United States. It's a gross topic. It's something that we don't really want to talk about at dinner time or anything, which I'll admit, yes. But we also look at it as kind of a funny inconvenience, and I want to reiterate that in these harsh environments, places like Haiti after the earthquake, people die from this, and they die from it in large numbers.
A lot of people die of this.
And it's from a lot of times dehydration, and the reason I believe Dr. Wilkie spent so much time going over making your water safe to drink is not just to prevent it in the first place, which is obviously a great thing to do, but in these environments, people are dehydrating and they keep drinking as much water as they can, but if they keep putting these things back into themselves, they're creating a cyclical cycle that can only end one place, and that's the grave. And the whole point of this show is to help you avoid that and to help you understand that we have this belief here in America that we are somehow in this little bubble of safety. But if you take away our sanitation and our systems of support, these things kill an American citizen with a $500,000 401k balance the same as they kill a poor person in Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
Oh, yeah. And worldwide, it's about the third leading cause of death, according to some statistics. Now, if you talk worldwide, kids less than 5 years old, it's one of the top killers, no doubt.
So if we're in that situation and we don't have access to these drugs, what's the best that we can do? If we end up in a really bad situation like this, somewhere in a harsh environment, something like some of the places you've been to, if you don't have antibiotics or other meds, what's the best we can do?
Yeah, you know, so if you're really that kind of, you know, screwed, so to speak, you know, you're really in the middle of nowhere, you have no access to antibiotics, somebody's going to have to be doing a lot to take care of you because you can really get incapacitated. And lots of fluids. You're going to have to use urine output as a measure, right? So what I'll tell a lot of people is you need to drink until you are peeing, right? You need to keep the fluids going. Now, one of the tricky things is some of these diseases will also have vomiting with it. Now, how do you get fluids into somebody that's puking? And that's the answer to that one's carefully. You'll typically give a teaspoon at a time, almost constantly. This takes, you know, almost hour by hour attention, you know, constant attention for sometimes days. You know, these bad cholera outbreaks that we've had in our nation's past. I mean, it wasn't that long ago cholera had major outbreaks and killed people in the United States. It's only been in our, you know, say the last century or half century where we've really made these types of advances. Even malaria. Malaria killed tons of people in the Civil War and before. So these things are not far distant for us. We've forgotten, but they're really not that far back. But yeah, so if you don't have antibiotics, it's just going to be this constant fluid replacement. And it needs to be water. And if you can get the salt and sugar in it, that's all that much better. And constant frequent sips, constant drinking.
Now, you did mention a lot of medications, and through hook or crook or just over the counter, people tend to, if you listen to the show anyway, stock up on some medications, including things like, if they have an opportunity to, even though maybe they're not supposed to, antibiotics. But when they're doing that, is there, because I get this question all the time, what about the storability of medications? What are the dangers? What are the risks? What are, you know, how long can something last? And I know some things just kind of don't work as good anymore, and other things can actually become dangerous.
Great question, too. And, you know, kind of going to the hook or crook side of the question about medicines is, you know, when you're traveling overseas, you can go to a physician that kind of specializes in travel medicine, and he'll write you for all kinds of prescriptions for the just in case and tell you how to use them. So I sort of view that same philosophy if you happen to be caught in Joplin, Missouri, or you're in one of the floodplains, and you just physically can't get to medical help. You know, so if you've got some understanding and background, and especially if you perhaps talk to your physician, you come up with this plan, I think it's a very reasonable and, you know, proper thing to do in terms of part of your planning. But how long can medicines last? This is a really interesting question. I've spent a lot of time digging through this. The food and drug industry, or the drug industry in particular, the pharmacy industry, is a lot of money. And I think they have a lot of financial interest in selling drugs, obviously. And so these expiration dates that they put on there probably have two functions. Number one, it's a CYA piece. And number two, they want to make sure that they continue to sell drugs. Well, the military was spending a ton of money on replacing drugs that have expired. They had them on just in case. They didn't use them. They expired, then they were getting rid of them. So the military got together with the FDA and actually did what was called the Shelf Life Extension Program, where they studied this. How long will drugs stay good? Can we use these on our soldiers, even if it's well past the expiration date? And interestingly enough, trying to get that original article, all the links on the Internet are now dead. I can't get the original article. But I was able to get lectures that referenced that article and had quotes and pieces out of that. So I've kind of pieced it together through a variety of different things. Because again, I've never been able to get the full text of the Shelf Life Extension Program.
But that's, what was the old line from Saturday Night Live? Isn't that special?
Yeah, exactly.
There's got to be something dirty in that. Well, folks, anybody out there that might have ever been privy to this, let us know. We'd like to receive that. Please continue, Dr. Wilkie.
Yeah, I would love to have a full copy of that one. So anyways, the military and the FDA studied over 200 different drugs. And basically, according to this, their data, you know, these will last at least 107 months additional to what's already on there. There was one quoted, you know, military study that said over 90% of the drugs were safe and effective after 15 years. Right? That's a long time. Now, this typically is a pill format or dry powder, you know, not a liquid, not an aerosol.
Sure.
And people also, definitely not water purification tablets. They failed. Once water purification tablets have exceeded their expiration date, throw them away. They're not good anymore. Now, one thing that's kind of bantered around, and I ascribe to this as well, this is where I was taught, was that tetracycline was a particularly dangerous one that you wanted to make sure that if it was expired, you don't use it.
I've always heard that, and I've always taught that. Is that not true?
Well, digging through this, where does that come from? That comes from a single case that was reported in 1963 where they just assumed that this tetracycline dose caused this renal failure and renal problems. And they noticed, well, the tetracycline that the patient took was expired, therefore we think that caused it. Well, there hasn't really been problems reported in the literature since then. And it's contested to say, well, did the disease that the person had that they were taking the tetracycline for, was that what caused the renal problem, and it has nothing to do with the tetracycline? So it's very contested. Nobody's really willing to do a study about testing it on patients after an expiration date because you have all kinds of ethical issues and doing that. But the data behind not using tetracycline that's expired is minimal, I'd say, at best. But otherwise, you know, all your normal standard pill format or powder drugs that aren't reconstituted, You know, I would store them in a reasonable way, in a cool, dry, dark place. Probably if you throw O2 absorbers in there, they'll make it even better, just like you would with food. And everything that I've learned, if these meds are 10 years old, 15 years old, and I've stored them properly, I would have no problem personally taking them.
And I would also say that my understanding has always been, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that other than this one thing with tetracycline, and that's the only one I know of, and if there's another one, again, please correct me, but other than that, any of these medications, what happens to them is their efficacy declines, if anything. They do not turn into a poison pill that's going to kill you.
Right, right. I have not come across anything that makes that, you know, type of fundamental shift. Like you said, you may have a little bit of drop in efficacy, but even when they were measuring that, they found that the efficacy drop was, you know, less than 10%, very minimal, even going out that far. And if anybody wants to dig, there was a Wall Street Journal article in 2000. The author was Lori Cohen, C-O-H-E-N. And she really kind of talks into this shelf life extension program and her research about the drug company and, you know, how much financial overlays in this and how much of it's business and how much of it's, you know, real for protection of patients. So if anybody wants to do any further digging or background checking, that's a good one to look at.
Great. I was going to ask you about this. I had an email on this recently. I haven't checked into it at all. Maybe you've heard of it, maybe you haven't, but if you had, I'd like your comments on it. I got an email, and what the person had said is that there's a new type of insulin that stores without refrigeration now.
Yeah, they're marketing that on TV quite a bit right now. It's sort of this injection pen. You know, that's something that has caught my attention as well. I want to find out how much of it's marketing, how much of it is, you know, real. But yes, it's one that doesn't require refrigeration. So you can put it in your pocket or put it in your purse and carry it with you all day and dose it, which I think would be a phenomenal thing. I've had several people that are type 1 diabetics asking me, what the heck would I do if I couldn't get my insulin for a period of time? And we really don't have a good answer to that one. You know, a good physician friend of mine that I'm going to try and have him put together, you know, one of our presentations, one of our slides for YouTube, because he's a type 1 diabetic. And this would have some very interesting possibilities if it's stable. It could be stored for any length of time without having refrigeration. I think that would be a great advancement. But I don't have a lot of details on that one yet, other than I know it does exist, but I don't know to what extent it's stable beyond that.
Very cool, because I'm very interested in that as well, because it's a question I get from anybody in the audience who's basically a diabetic is clearly concerned about this. And I get, even if I have 6 months of diabetic medication stored in my refrigerator, freezer, whatever, it does me no good if the power goes out and I can't get power back on and it all goes bad.
Right.
So that's one we need kind of some more research on, but it's promising.
And talking to the type 2 diabetics that are out there, and there's a lot of type 2 diabetics, using the medicines help a little bit. They don't really help that much. You know, we do everything we can because the consequences of diabetes are severe, but taking your insulin or taking your oral pills for diabetes, you know, isn't a miraculous effect like people would hope. It's not like insulin in a type 1 diabetic. So if you're caught without resources and you're a type 2 diabetic, proper nutrition, good hydration, weight loss, that will do phenomenal changes and potentially, you know, change you from being a diabetic to a non-diabetic.
And not to lecture, but that's what they should be doing now.
That's what you should be doing now. Very, very true.
You know, I mean, it's a condition people don't have to have. I believe that. I don't think there's very many people that are type 2 diabetics that have to be.
Right.
It's a lifestyle thing.
It is a lifestyle, because we're seeing it a lot in kids. We used never saw type 2 diabetes in kids, and now we're starting to see it.
Yeah, I was watching that show, Jamie Oliver's Food Revolution, and he was trying to, the first series, and he was trying to get through to this DJ who just thought, you know, he was a nut job and wanted to take away the strawberry milk from kids and all. And the way he finally got through to him is he got him to meet him at a place, and he took him to a funeral home, and he showed him these new caskets they're having to make to bury people because the people won't fit in a normal casket. And it was this casket that looked like you could fit a Volkswagen in. And the guy said, man, maybe we really do need to do something. And it's stuff like that in our kids and stuff. So kind of shifting gears a little bit, because I have a lot of people that are very concerned right now, and I've been kind of the let's keep a lid on this thing. Let's not overreact to it. But there's a lot of people still very, very concerned about Fukushima and radioactivity and fallout, and it's going to get us over here. And there's some guy on the radio, I won't say who he is, but we all know who I'm talking about, would say, you know, he's like, there's a giant cloud of death heading for America right now, and they're lying to you about it. You did this fabulous presentation on radiation exposure on YouTube. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. I don't want to get through the whole thing, but just your general thoughts on, should the average American sitting over here right now be worried about radiation fallout at a high level from Japan? And then kind of, you know, the other side, though, if you were living in Tokyo right now, would you be concerned?
Right, well, I'm currently wearing a completely lead-lined suit and popping potassium pills every 30 seconds. So that's what I recommend for everybody right now. But no, I have no concern about what happened in Fukushima about having a serious impact on me. Could they detect microscopic amounts of a radioisotope in the western United States? Sure they could. Is it going to be much more than what would be present in background radiation? Probably not. I'm not in any way freaked out about what's going on in Japan. If I lived in Japan, that's a little bit different story. You know, fallout is important. Yes, it can go up in the atmosphere. Yes, it can be there for a while. But again, we are always exposed to small amounts of chronic radiation throughout our lives, whether it's from the sun or whether it's from radon. Radon's probably the most common one. You know, our bodies know it. We've lived this way for a long time. And so putting a little bit here and there, you know, from something that's halfway across the world doesn't freak me out. Now, where I live, you know, there's a nuclear reactor nearby. So, you know, I think you need to be cognizant for what's around you. If I lived in Tokyo or if I lived somewhere around there, I think it's probably reasonable to take potassium until data comes in where you know where things stand. Now, again, potassium is only going to protect your thyroid from taking up a radioactive form of iodine. It doesn't do anything else for any of the other types of radiation exposure you're going to have. So it's also probably important to know, you know, what is fallout? How long do I need to be worried about? What do I do for my food and water? And just some of these basic things to reduce the chances that you concentrate some of these radioisotopes within you. It's important when you talk about eating fish or something that you have this concentrating effect as you move up the food chain into larger and larger fish. So living in Tokyo, yeah, I'd have my concerns. I'd try and be prudent about it. I wouldn't be living in a bomb shelter. I would definitely wash my food with water that I knew was uncontaminated, wash it well. You know, I would probably take potassium if I was anywhere near Fukushima or if I was in part of the pathway of a cloud. Again, until we think some of the isotopes are going to fall out and not be much of an issue.
I agree completely. My one thing I am a bit concerned about, though, is seafood. Would you have any concerns with seafood right now with all the stuff that dumped in the ocean? Maybe I basically said if it comes out of the Sea of Japan right now, you couldn't pay me to eat it.
Yeah, that's a bit of a problem for me. I love sushi. If it's being shipped over from Japan after what's gone on, you know, there would be a little bit of a concern. It's like, well, how much is being concentrated now? Knowing the fallout that people would get, no pun intended using the word fallout, but knowing the crap that the government would take letting something in that tested positive for some of these things, you know, I think there's probably some reasonable screening tools that may be in place. Not that I want to put an excessive amount of trust in an organization I think has multiple flaws, but it would be a political nightmare and disaster for them. So I'm sure they've got a lot of concerns with any imports coming from that side of the world. And so I'm not going to stop eating fish here in the States. I would probably not be eating sushi in Tokyo. And if there's a sushi place or someplace I'm going to eat is getting a lot of import from Japan, I may wait a couple of months personally until we get some more information on that.
Okay.
But if I happen to eat one fish that was caught somewhere in the Pacific that, again, has a trace amount of something in it, it's probably not a concern. This is not like palladium or some other weaponized level of radioactive isotope like that guy, that Russian guy that got knocked off by the KGB.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. I think it was in London that happened. And what I keep trying to remind people of is, and I'm not saying this was a good thing when they did it, but in the 60s, our government detonated nuclear weapons in the Nevada desert. And to me, there was probably a lot more exposure from that inside the United States than there would have been from anything that happens in Japan.
Right. And we didn't have tons of people dropping dead across the United States from that. And even if you look at the people that were exposed to radiation with the atomic bombs at Nagasaki and Hiroshima, you know, there was a good number of people that were exposed and never had complications or problems to it.
Absolutely. Well, let's not beat that one up too much. I kind of want to move on to kind of another subject now if we can. I'd like to talk about what people should be doing in their own homes to be prepared to deal without medical help. So what are some of the things that should be in that first aid kit that should be, you should look at making as much a part of your long-term storage as the beans and bullets on the Band-Aid side of things? And maybe what kind of training should a person try to get? Because here's the thing. I see people all the time that are like, you know, they buy these emergency field hospital backpack or whatever. And I'm like, what do you think you're going to do with that? I mean, if you're a doc, fine. But, you know, these guys, you know, like failed high school biology and now they have a surgical kit. I don't think they're going to get that far with that. But I think there are things we can do that will save lives.
Yeah, definitely. And Jack, let me apologize if my thing's breaking up a little bit. Let me know. I'm in a hospital using the hospital wireless. So
no, you're good right now.
Okay. So I get this question a lot from family and friends. What do you do to get ready? Well, all right. What are the most common things you're likely to encounter? Just apply your common sense and what you've experienced in the past. And they'll probably tell you a good number of things. Cuts, scrapes, you know, breaks in the skin, those are fairly common. Things that, you know, people fall, they injure themselves doing work, so potential broken bones, those are fairly common. And then you've got, you know, your typical snotty noses, coughs, congestions, flu-like illnesses that are out there. So if I'm building a kit to kind of get prepared for being without some access to medical help, that's kind of where I'd put my first attention. I would say, how am I going to close a wound, and what do I need to know about closing a wound? And, you know, what are things that I could, you know, obtain as a layperson, and then what, you know, or perhaps some more advanced things? What sort of training do people need? Well, there's all kinds of stuff that's out there. Like I said, YouTube is sort of revolutionizing education in a sense. You know, YouTube and all the other things like YouTube. I'm using that just as an example. But you can find a tremendous amount of information that's out there. Now, reading about it or watching a video and actually having proficiency are two very different things. Like when you talk about planting a garden so that you know how to do it in case you ever had to, the same would apply here. You need to practice it and do it a little bit, because doing it for the first time is probably not the best time to try and put it all together. So Band-Aids, super glue is what we use to, you know, glue wounds together. Now we use the FDA approved fancy super glue, but it's basically cyanoacrylate, which is the same stuff. I've closed wounds using duct tape, you know, a good sticky duct tape, you know, not the crappy ones that fall off when you start sweating just a little bit. So there's a variety of things you can do, up into, you know, closing with stitches. Now vets know how to stitch pretty well, or guys that are farmers that have stitched animals will know how to stitch. It's no different, you know, on a person to an animal. And the key thing is, anytime you're closing a wound, before you close it, you want to make sure it's very clean. You don't want to close in bacteria or other debris that will set up a bad infection. You know, so having it under some running water for 15 minutes, 10 minutes will be a huge help. If it's a grossly contaminated wound, let's say you sliced your hand because a cow stepped on it and then you have a bunch of manure in there, that one you probably don't want to close. You want to let it just heal from the bottom up so you don't close in a really nasty infection. So I'd learn basic wound care. That's a big one. How do you deal with fractures? That's the next video I'm trying to put together. I got a request from one of the people that are following me on YouTube. And that's a really interesting one, because how do you diagnose a fracture without an x-ray machine? Obviously, if your arm's bent at 90 degrees where it shouldn't be, that's probably a good indicator. But if you don't have that, how can you tell? Well, there's one thing you can do if you have a tuning fork and a stethoscope. So bones will transmit sound kind of like any other solid object. So sound travels better in water than it does air. Same sort of principle applies. So if you put a stethoscope on one end of a bone and then a tuning fork on the other end of the same bone, if it's not broken, it'll be a fairly loud sound. And you can compare it to the other side of the body to make sure, okay, that sounds about the same as this other side that's not hurt. Now, if you're listening and the sound is greatly diminished, that probably indicates that there's a broken bone right there. So that's sort of the poor man's x-ray machine. It's just using a tuning fork and a stethoscope. So then once you figure something's broken, you need to know, well, it takes probably about 6 weeks to heal. And in that 6 weeks, you need to immobilize it in as straight of way as possible so that the bones heal correctly and you don't have loss of function. I'd spend some time in that. You can get basic EMT training. That's always a very good thing. It helps you understand more about diseases other than just broken bones and skin cuts. You start learning about respiratory stuff. You start learning about cardiovascular. I think everybody, since it's free, I would at least have a PDF version of this book called Where There Is No Doctor. This was written by a guy who was doing some missionary work in Mexico. He was not medically trained whatsoever, and he realized he wasn't able to effectively do what he wanted to on the mission side until he realized, I need to take care of these people's basic needs. Some of their basic needs included health issues. So he has written, as a layperson, written a book that's really very good, very well done. And he talks about how do you provide healthcare where there's a no doctor. So if you Google Where There Is No Doctor and you go to their website, you can actually get a free PDF of the entire book.
And I'll put a link to that today in the show notes. And I'll say this, it's the hard copy, and there's times when electronics fail, and that may be a time when you most need to rely on this as a reference, but I have a hard copy of this in my library, and if you're looking to, like, fill out that prepper library, so to speak, I can't recommend that book highly enough. And as Dr. Wilkie says, it's written by a layman. I can read it, and I get it, and I understand it, and I know what to do. And I think that's more valuable to me than, like, a surgical manual or something like that, where you guys, when you go to medical school, Dr. Wilkie, you learn the laborious name of everything. But if somebody spits out a six-syllable Latin word and it says it's adjacent to that, well, you know what the hell that means, where I'm going, what the heck is that? So I think that's an outstanding reference that every prepper should have.
All right. I usually buy that book in groupings of six or, you know, to ten. Whenever we travel to, you know, any place, we pass those out left and right. It's a great, great tool.
You have traveled to some pretty harsh environments, and you've given medical treatment in places like Africa, and I imagine probably not the Johannesburg, South Africa that you fly into that's nice for a vacation. What are some of the biggest lessons you've learned by being in those environments and treating people in those environments?
The biggest thing that I learned is how important water is. I know that I've kind of pounded on that one a little bit, but that's such a fundamental key need. You have to make sure that if you don't have clean water, you know how to make it clean, or you know how to make it safe. That's the number one thing that sticks out in my mind every time I've gone over there. The second thing is you will be surprised how much you can do with not that much, as long as you have a little bit of background and training. I mean, we've taken teeth out using a Leatherman. I've used my multi-tool. My multi-tool I've used to stitch things up. So there's a lot of kind of band-aids, duct tape, safety pin type medicine you can do. I think it's key to understand and have a certain supply of some medications. Now, some of those should, you know, probably fall in the antibiotic category, but also what about Imodium to slow down diarrhea and prevent volume loss, you know, with a diarrhea illness? How do you make an oral rehydration solution if you don't have Gatorade or Pedialyte or something along those lines? You know, how it'd be great to make sure you have something for just pain and discomfort, you know, ibuprofen, Tylenol, you know, whatever you want, whatever's your drug of choice for that. You know, my wife makes sure that we have more bottles of ibuprofen in the house because, you know, once a month, that is the number one drug of choice in our household. I also have a daughter. So they've made sure that we will not do without that particular medicine.
you know, you also are open to, I guess, what we've come to call alternative therapies today, where I call them traditional therapies. I watched one of your videos on using honey to treat wounds. And, you know, that's generally not what you hear an emergency room physician talking about. But if it works, it works. And what are some of your thoughts on some things like that?
Yeah, I think the last sentence you just said, if it works, it works. Now, you know, I've sort of straddle a line. From my standpoint, I want data showing it works. I want somebody that puts it through a test that's well-designed, that shows that there's good effect. You know, but to think that it has to be produced by Pfizer or Schering Plough to be an effective treatment, I think, is also perhaps maybe a little short-sighted. A lot of the medicines are derived from a natural source to begin with. You know, penicillin is a great example. Taxol, which they use for breast cancer treatment, came from the bark of a tree. You know, honey was something that they studied, and they compared it to these antibiotic ointments that we'd place on wounds, and it did as good, if not better, than these expensive, medications. So there's very well-designed stuff, and when I see that, I'm like, boy, honey's a lot cheaper, it's more plentiful, and if it works better, then, you know, why not use it?
And I think there's things that we can just observe and see that work. For instance, I don't care what a study says or doesn't say, I know that calendula will reduce inflammation and pain, stinging and itching on insect bites because I've done it. It worked. And I know that aloe vera will reduce the pain and stinging of a burn because I've done it and it works. And I mean, I'm with you. I think there's a lot of snake oil salesmen, and I think they do tremendous damage to the alternative therapies industry. You know, the guy that sells the coral calcium, and he does a pseudo talk show. Guy calls in and goes, yeah, my wife has cancer. Oh, take coral calcium. Next guy calls in, my leg's ready to be amputated from gangrene. Ah, take coral calcium. It'll be fine. I got bit by a shark. Ah, give him some coral calcium. And you know what I mean? That kind of stuff is nonsense. But I think there's a lot of things out there. And as you say, a lot of the things that we're using in medicine today have natural sources.
Right, right. And, you know, and I would like to increase my knowledge base off of, you know, because I've used aloe myself. You know, you get a burn, you go out, you break the aloe off, you squeeze it on, you know. You know, so what are some, that's an area of interest that I'm trying to delve into more and more, you know, about how well does echinacea work? Have we studied it? You know, what are some things out there so I can increase my repertoire of things that I'm aware of and know? And again, the difference between something that you would get out in nature and something that you get from a pill bottle, the thing that the pill bottle has is it's going to be a purified, concentrated form, so the chances that you notice an effect may be larger just because of the way it's produced. That doesn't mean this other thing doesn't have something that works, but it may just be hard to get it in a large enough volume to get the same kind of effect. Now, again, it doesn't mean that you can't get some effect or some benefit out of it by any stretch.
And I think the disconnect between, let's say, the two worlds lies in this. As a doctor, especially as an emergency doctor, you have people come to you with an acute condition that needs to be fixed now. And a lot of these things that are more of an alternative methodology are not so much, okay, you know, like I've always said this, if I get an accident and I have a yield sign in my spleen, I want you taking care of me this second. I don't want to see a naturopath. I really don't. I don't even want to get in the way of you trying to save my life. But some of these things seem to have a much better preventative effect or a stabilizing effect. And there's things that aren't even really considered therapy or medicine. It just, we know they work because we know what they do in the body. For instance, Apis Americana or groundnut controls insulin response, and it is an appetite suppressant. And it we don't have to study the groundnut to really understand this. We have to know its components, and we have to know that since it contains certain things that do that, well, then it's a source of those things, like any other thing in our diet that would do that. And I think that what people, I guess the issue is, and why this stuff doesn't work better for people, is it requires responsibility on the person, where if I'm sick and I come to you and you say, okay, you have this bacterial infection, here's an antibiotic, my only responsibility is to avoid, you know, let's say maybe alcohol while I'm taking it, and to take it the way you told me until the bottle's empty. Where if it's, I'm going to have to control my diet, I'm going to have to pay attention, I'm going to have to gauge my own responses, it takes more work and it takes more effort.
It does. And, you know, and you're sort of also hinting at a larger issue with just staying healthy. You know, the chances that you can respond to a, you know, severe stress to your body, you know, whether it's injury or infection, you know, greatly depends on your overall health. So everything you can do to improve your overall health just puts you that much better positioned for what might come your way.
And what are some of the things that you think people don't do in America that they should be doing to not even just like fix their health, but to maintain it in the first place?
This will sound like the broken record, but, you know, Americans, we're lazy, fat, and happy. We're rich as a nation, you know. Granted, we're going through a terrible recession. We've got people out of work. But compared to the third world, you know, putting it in that type of perspective, there's no comparison.
Our poor people have air conditioners and big-screen TVs and drive vehicles. So, yeah, right. We're rich as a nation.
Yeah, and so again, I don't want to take away from the one individual who's going through a very tough time, but speaking globally, it's night and day difference. So, because, you know, we've been so fortunate with everything that we've had access to, you know, we don't work as hard. You don't see, when I go to Africa, you don't see a bunch of fat people. That's just not there. You know, your diet, you know, eating things that are healthy, you know. I love the way that you talk about gardening because, you know, eating fresh fruits, fresh vegetables, stuff that doesn't have a bunch of crap on it is probably a great thing to do. You know, increase your fiber intake decreases the chance you get colon cancer. You know, exercising regularly. And again, it doesn't have to be going to Gold's Gym and, you know, doing your reps, doing with the sit-ups or pull-ups or bench press, but, you know, just doing reasonable labor, you know, or something that will help your cardiovascular status with your endurance as well as some muscle strength, that goes a long way. As we age, you know, we lose calcium in our bones, but the more you use your muscles, the more you have resistance training, you know, or you're carrying milk jugs or you're carrying the, you know, 5-gallon water pail out to the chickens or whatever, that uses your muscles, that helps strengthen the bones, it helps prevent that calcium loss. So, you know, kind of like you're going to a, in one sense, going to what we've done for centuries before we got so advanced and, again, fat and lazy and happy is, you know, get out and actually do some work. Eat healthy. Eat right. Those two things, I think, will go a tremendous way. And, again, I think it sort of fits the mindset of a lot of the people that probably tune in to listen to your stuff. You know, they want to be more self-sufficient and, you know, more active on their own anyways.
Absolutely, absolutely. If people want to learn more about, you know, what you're doing and the information you're sharing, you have several resources available, right?
I'm trying to get better at that. This all sort of started back on putting some stuff up on YouTube, and what initially triggered this is there were some people that would go to Africa and do some of this mission work, but if I didn't go with them or if they didn't have a doctor or nurse and they came across one of these problems, I'm like, boy, you're going to be in a real world of hurt. So I started to try and put this together originally to help people that might be going out into the boonies. And then as I think a lot of us several years ago when you start putting things together on your own, thinking, boy, our country's really pretty broke, and I don't see anybody taking any serious steps to fix this. And what happens when, you know, we're no longer a permanent, you know, status in the world, and our currency is less value, and you start playing these things out in your head, and you're like, well, I think it'd be irresponsible of me not to take steps to make sure my family's taken care of. And so it sort of evolved from some people perhaps going to the third world to now saying more local or more close to home, it's what do we need to do, you know, for ourselves to make sure that we can take care of ourselves and not have to rely on things that may not be available to us. So YouTube is where most things are, and it's, you know, just under, you know, YouTube/user/survivalmedicine. That's where I put up most of it. But then to try and augment that, and people have asked me to put some more stuff in writing, so it's not just the video stuff, but they would get something, you know, in print. I've started a site at Tumblr where I can put some of this information, and that's, you know, survivalmedicine.tumblr.com. And then, you know, hearing you rant about Facebook, you know, I'm trying to get better at Facebook, and I haven't quite figured out what the page name is, so I'll see if I can get that to you. I'll have to ask my daughter how to name the page.
Yeah, it'd be a good idea to add that as part of the URL so you can give it out the way you just did the other stuff. But email me the link, and even if you change the name, the hard back link that's there now will still forward, and I'll get that in the show notes so people can connect with you there. I'd like to thank you for the effort that you're making. Generally speaking, doctors aren't totally broke, and you're probably not doing this to try to make a fortune or anything. You're doing it because you want to help people, and you want to help your community, and hopefully you guys won't end up broke with the new Obamacare that's headed down the pike. I know a lot of doctors are really, really concerned about that.
Yeah, you know, I have my own concerns, largely because we just started a very expensive program that I don't know how we're going to pay for. Do I want less access to care? Absolutely not. You know, you hate seeing people come in that are injured or ill, and you know you want to help them. That's why we go into this business. Physicians are well paid, no doubt about it. You know, I'm not going to complain that, you know, I'm barely scratching by. But if you look, healthcare in the United States is insanely expensive, but that huge amount of cost is not going to physicians. If you match it to 1990s dollars,
no, I completely agree with you on that.
It's actually gone down by comparison, but. Again, not that we're hurting. I'll take that as a misstatement. But talking to my friends and looking at surveys, there looks like a very significant portion of doctors that are thinking of getting out of the field or retiring early.
And I think it's the general practitioners that are the most concerned about this. Our genius and commander-in-chief has a new plan to basically, if you're qualified to go to medical school, if you'll commit to a certain number of years of practicing as a GP, we'll just pay for your school, because they're that concerned about losing the GPs.
Right. Well, there's already a shortage. It's hard to get people. I'm sure if you've got somebody that's out in your audience that's on Medicare and they don't have a doctor, trying to find a doctor that takes Medicare, sometimes it's tricky. Same with Medicaid. Now, if we're right about the surveys about people that will leave the field out of just dissatisfaction from, you know, the ever encroaching, you know, governmental oversight, I think that's another important reason for people to kind of start self-educating about medicine, because it may be harder to get in to see somebody. It may take longer to get in to see somebody. You know, you may need to know what questions to ask once you finally get there, so that you take charge of your own medical well-being. Never be afraid to ask a doctor a lot of questions. You know, you get somebody that's not willing to answer your questions, go to a different doctor. That, you know, they should never have their ego hurt by you challenging or questioning them, because as much as I try and pretend that I'm not, I'm very fallible. I will make mistakes, and my wife will tell you lots of mistakes I've made if you want some proof on that one. But it's important just to, you know, again, educate yourself that even if nothing bad ever happens to us, right, nothing, no economic problems, nothing, everything's great, there's a good chance we'll all get sick at some point, And the more you know and can ask, the better the chances that you'll get appropriate treatment.
I was wondering real quick since you brought that up. I say this a lot, and I wonder if you've seen it maybe in a different way. But I've talked to two different oncologists, folks that I know fairly well, that have said that when they're treating a cancer patient and they've got that person with that kind of 50-50 probability or maybe even like 60-40 on the negative side, where it's a reasonable expectation this person's not going to make it, that the patient, even if they're both the same and they both end up doing the same thing, the patient that's a pain in the ass, that wants to know why we're doing this, is there an alternative, why do I feel this way, can we change this, that person tends to beat the odds more often than the compliant person because they know what they do matters. Have you seen that in medical practice, that a certain will or desire or activity on the patient increases recovery time, increases survivability?
Absolutely. And now, from an emergency stance, where you see them for a short period of time, you don't get the benefit of something
sure.
like you're talking about. But this is studied in a bunch of different levels. Those with a good attitude, those that laugh more, those that are more, engaged or willing to fight or whatever, the life expectancy and all of that is better. Again, even if you take people that, where they look at just how interested they are in interacting with other people, the ones that are just enjoy life, they typically live longer than the people that don't, even with all things being the same.
Yeah.
So I think you're saying about mental attitude is very important.
Awesome. And then there's the old joke that says something like, what is it, that married men live longer but they're more willing to die or something like that?
That's right. I can tell you about the drop in testosterone that men get after they get married.
But hey, anyway, Dr. Wilkie, this has been a great interview. I really appreciate you coming on here. I'd like to propose something. I'd love to have you back sometime if you'd like to come back. And what I think would be cool is we could just kind of poll the audience here at the end of the day and say, I'm sure there's questions you have about medicine and emergency medicine and shit at the fan scenarios and anything else we can think of. Send me email, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com, and if it's for Dr. Wilkie, put question for the doc in the subject line. I'll put together 10-20 questions, and we'll get you back on to answer those questions from the audience. And that way we'll give the audience exactly what they want to know, from maybe not the answer they want, but we'll get answers to the questions they want answers to.
That'd be great. I'd love to do that.
That'd be awesome. Love to have you come back on again. Thank you for being on today. And folks, I hope you learned a lot today. I know I did. I know I have a new view on some of these things and reinforced some old ideas as well. And I will put links to all of Dr. Wilkie's social media connections so you can get in touch with him that way, so please do so. And I'd love to hear your questions. I'm sure Dr. Wilkie would as well. And with that, I'll go ahead and wrap up today. This has been Jack Spierko, along with Dr. Eric Wilkie, helping you figure out how to live that better life and maintain that better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Well, thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Survival Podcast Friday Flashbacks. If you enjoyed today's show, please consider becoming an MSB member. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more. You can also support our show by going to TSPAZ, that's T-S-P-A-Z, TSPAZ.com. Anytime you shop online, and while you'll support us no matter what you buy, you will find over 500 reviews of items I have personally tested and vouched for. And to stay in touch with us and never miss anything, follow our channel or our group on Telegram. You can find links to that and all our social media options. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and check the show notes for any episode.